Hey everyone, welcome back. It's been, well, a couple more months than I'm going to count because that makes me sound lazy. We're back with another episode of the 343 Sparcast. My name is David Ellis. I'm a designer here at 343 Industries, and we have a special episode for you today. Frank O'Connor could not be here. It's past his nap time. I think he had to go to bed or something. But we have some very special guests lined up. And so I'll just go ahead and introduce everyone, and we'll get right into it. I'm going to go clockwise, because that works better for my brain. To my left is Chris Schlurf, who is senior writer here at 343.
Hello, everyone.
And this is your first time on the podcast.
First podcast.
Welcome.
I'm very excited.
And to his left, it's a voice that should be familiar to listeners of this particular podcast, Mr. Greg Baer, back once again. Welcome, Greg.
Great to be back. Thanks.
And rounding things out, coming back again after... Oh,
been a
God.
While.
It's been probably almost 2 years since last time you were on. Last time
I think
was
so.
Noble Matt Pack.
Was it Noble or Defiant?
No, it was Noble.
No. Wow.
Yeah, it was Noble
a while ago.
Matt Pack. So that's Jeremy Patnout, formerly known as Mr. Vociferous.
Formerly, yeah.
And maybe still currently, occasionally, depending on if he's getting his fan letters delivered.
I call
or
him
not.
Boss.
I just want a retired persona. I want to say, oh, yeah, I'm not that guy anymore.
Sorry. So Jeremy's franchise radio here at 343. He and I used to work together. We were on the same team when we first started out here many, many, many years ago. So if you haven't put the pieces together yet now, we're actually going to be talking a little bit about Cylindium, which is book 3 in the Forerunner Saga, which is coming out March 19th. If that's not accurate, that means my press release in my hands is inaccurate. So I am blameless. But according to everything, and it's coming out March 19th, book 3, obviously coming on the heels of Cryptum, the first title, and Primordium, book 2. Of course, we pushed out Cylindium a little bit. It was originally going to come out a little earlier, pushed it out a bit. And we're going to talk a little bit about that book, the previous books in the Forerunner Saga, and maybe tie in a little bit of the story elements from Halo 4. Obviously, a lot's been revealed since last time we've done a podcast. So obviously, a lot of questions out there. Perhaps we'll be able to answer a couple. But in my mind, hopefully more questions come out of this, because that's always fun to see all the different theories and things posted online. So I guess we'll kind of kick things off. Greg, do you want to kind of catch us up as Cylindium kicks off? Do you want to talk us back a little bit about what is the state of the Halo universe as it exists at the beginning of Cylindium? Obviously, Cryptum introduced the character of Bornstellar and the Didact, and really kind of fleshed out the Forerunner, the species of the Forerunners and what their kind of caste system was like. Primordium took us onto a Halo ring and dealt with the precursors and a lot of other elements involved in it. I mean, there were some big revelations in both books. So where are we at as Cylindium kicks off?
We're kind of at the crux point of the whole Halo universe. They're preparing to use the Halos for the purpose they were intended for. And that means that the librarian has to gather up her specimens. And we've seen that in different demonstrations, but to imagine the magnitude of it, you can do that much more cheaply in a novel. Mm-hmm. So she's got lots of work to do, and she is involved with the investigatory branch of the Forerunners, which is collectively known as... the judiciary, but also known as the...
the juridicals?
The juridicals and the catalog. Catalog, you cannot say in plural because they get insulted. When they give up their Forerunner status, they assume the mantle and they become almost as one. But there's a little bit of back and forth as to whether they actually are as one or not, how much of their original Forerunner status remains with them. They are there to investigate what may be a crime against the mantle. And that's one of the deep underlying questions in Cylindium, is how much of this is, in fact, a crime against the mantle. Who is going to assume the mantle? We have human characters. We have, of course, humans now made machine and made part of this whole effort. And we have Bornstellar, who was not quite forcibly imprinted with the Didact and his imago, so to speak. And Bornstellar is a different sort of Didact. The Didact's path and his path, the Bornstellar Didact and the Ur-Didact, have parted ways. The Ur-Didact is going through an awful lot more trauma in this book to become the Didact we see in the game.
So this is an interesting concept, and something we talked a little bit about from the books. But in the game, it's not really spelled out that there, in fact, are two distinct Didacts that exist at this point in time in the distant past.
Well, we actually don't know that what Bornstellar's condition is in the time of the game.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that's being held either in reserve or it's resolved elsewhere. I don't know.
We don't talk about such things.
But you talked about that their paths went down, obviously gone down very distinct and different paths.
Well, it's a triangle. It's a romantic triangle. It's
right.
Two didacts and the librarian. And how she handles all of this in the context of what romance means to forerunners is really the core of what's going on in the book. Also the revelation of what the precursors were up to way back when. And we won't talk too much about that, but there's some major revelations in Silentium as to their connections to what powers the entire Halo game.
Chris, from your perspective, incorporating the didact as obviously the key element, I think, from an antagonist standpoint in Halo 4, both within the game and also the terminals, which really flesh out his story quite a bit more. So what was your experience like working both with Greg, but apart from Greg? Because obviously you're not here in the office every day, Greg, and we're going down different paths and everything throughout the normal iterative kind of production process. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think, Greg, you and I basically came into the Halo world around the same time. Yeah, I remember you coming in for the kickoff probably within a month after I started here.
Right, and I started seeing sketches of what they assumed the didact would look like, and I thought they were cool. And that process began, I think, about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, in fact, the first time you did the podcast, which was the first episode, we talked about that. We couldn't say what the name of the character was at that point, but if you go back and listen to it, that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, and that was such an evolution, I mean, even from them to now. But, I mean, the one thing that we always had in mind for the didact is that he was going to be this noble figure, and we had, the whole history, that was the whole purpose of doing the books, was to really flesh him out as a character. You know, it's interesting because with the game, we obviously have an infinitely more compressed time frame to work with. And, you know, one of the very important things for us was that it had to make sense to people that did not read the books, that would understand him simply as the antagonist of the game. And yet that you also felt like, you know, having gone through, you know, the first two and now once the third is out, that you had a far, far deeper understanding of the character. Definitely for us, I think we all have a strong affinity for the didact as a character. Largely because you look at the history of what he's been through and the decisions he had to make and the wars that he fought. And, you know, there are definitely parallels with the present story that we've been telling with the Master Chief. And, you know, again, obviously we've already talked about the Reclaimer saga coming up.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, Greg, you brought up the character of the Librarian, which for me was a personal joy, was actually that character got to be realized within Halo 4 and also Spartan Ops. That was kind of fun for me because she'd always been this character that spoke to me from the terminals of Halo 3. Interesting. She's in a lot of ways, she's the mother of humans as we know them today and in 500 years in the future when Halo takes place.
Well, starting with that is where it all begins for me because I'm a bit of a Jungian. And when I saw the Librarian, I instantly recognized who we're dealing with here. And she is both a combination of the grays in the sense of the faces that everyone sees as a baby. This shape that looks very much like a UFO being, and the maternal face that we also see and attach ourselves to. We are very interested in faces. So the notion that she imprinted her face on all of humanity as her final reckoning, I think, really touches the core of what she wanted to do and what she was up against. In a sense, the Forerunners are tragic figures because, yes, they seem to do things wrong on a regular basis, but the forces and pressures they're up against are so extraordinary that they become much more sympathetic in that. And even the didact, as nasty an antagonist as it is, in Silentium, you're going to follow that progress. We all worked very hard to make that progress make sense in terms of both the story and the game, to give you a complete arc for what he's up against. And when you play the game after reading Silentium, you will see more tragic depth than just a massively threatening character.
Yeah, infinitely. So I think again, it's interesting for people that'll play the game first and then go back to the books, right? Because I think they'll have a very distinct impression of what the didact is according to the game, but the book humanizes them, you know.
There are a lot of revelations in the game that came along that I thought were just fabulous. We did one aspect of a story and suddenly be implanted into the game story. Mm-hmm. We'd say, okay, you have this going on, this technological advance. You know, you can have spaceships with the last impressions of their previous occupants before they died. And then suddenly that gets taken up and run with in the game in a totally unexpected way. And as you're playing the game and it gets revealed what you're doing, suddenly you have a shock of guilt. What the hell are you doing? I thought that was excellent. That was really full science fiction depth for me.
Yeah, there's definitely a large aspect of morality play that we wanted to bring into it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the idea of the
actions have consequences.
Completely so, right? And again, some of those consequences can never be erased.
No.
And I think that, you know, the one of the fantastic things about exploring the Dyadic as a character, especially in the time frame of the game, is the fact that you do have, you know, 100,000 years of perspective to look back on.
Yeah, what's interesting, the Dyadic that you come across in the game is, in some cases, a fully fleshed, fully realized, he made his choice and his path a long time ago, and he is set in stone. He's not malleable at all.
He's very old.
Exactly. Yeah. And whereas the characters that were introduced in whichever Dyadic you're talking about, in a lot of ways, very different from the one that you actually come across in the game.
Yeah, entirely.
Certainly in the first two books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then in Silentium, you get to see that final push, that final turn of the screw that shoves him into being what you see in the game, and which changes the librarian's perspective towards her husband's too, mm-hmm. and what she's doing. But she's also taking her own deep journey, which she's remembering and going back to when she left and went to the Greater Magellanic Cloud to describe, to understand the history of why there was such a massive push of Forerunner might against that galaxy, that small satellite galaxy, in the past. And she comes across a revelation which is devastating and is very Greek in a lot of ways. It's very much, you know, kind of a Jupiter Kronos type of thing.
Mm-hmm. I found her arc probably the most interesting in the trilogy of books now that I've, you know, gone through and read them through several times. But I find it interesting because she's viewed initially like as a deity to some degree by the characters and the perspectives that you have in Cryptum and then in Primordium even. But in this book, there's a shift that goes on where she's definitely still the librarian, but she's a victim in a lot of ways, and it's kind of interesting to see her, you know, pivot from being this character that everybody looks up to as a god to a character that is really having to turn on her heels to respond to situations that, you know, we would see
outside of her control.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Well, nobody thinks of gods as victims of circumstance. Nobody thinks of gods as you know, reactionary.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think that's a wonderful thing, and it's what makes them such fun characters to play with. Is that,
and that was inherent from the very beginning. These things are implied in the very structure of the early terminal dialogues, all that sort of thing. Making it work is not exactly easy, and yet the outline is laid out for us. And that's why I said there's really great bone structure in this story. Mm-hmm. For me, a lot of it just fell right into place as to you're looking at the Halos. They're huge. Who's in charge of Halo civilization? The builders, of course. They make things, mm-hmm. right? And they're got to be contractors. So, you know, between your contractor liens and all this sort of thing, they're going to control mm-hmm. the civilization. But the warriors at one point would have been key. And so now they're reduced to the class of servant warriors. They used to be warriors. Now they're servant warriors. So this whole back and forth of a civilization as it not only matures but responds to the enormous pressure being put on, as we learn in the novels, from forces that are even more ancient than they realize.
You're talking about characters who have been victims, and I think one of the big revelations, and if you haven't read Primordium and you don't know all the spoilers, we are going to go into some little bit of spoiler territory here, the character of Chakas and the revelation that 343 Guilty Spark and Chakas are one and the same.
Well, 343 is one of the main characters in the games and in the fan estimation.
And he's the the name for our very studio as
well.
He's
perverse, and you wonder where that perversity comes from. And characters that are perverse are beloved like game players and readers. And that occurred in our first meeting. In the first meeting, Frank and Kevin and who else was there? Was that just?
I think it was just the four of us.
Yeah.
No, when Eric was there too.
Eric was there, and before we went into the breakfast meeting in downtown Seattle in a bright sunny morning, Eric looks over at me, and he's my Halo player. He's played all the games and run me through them and everything. He says, "You know, your Forerunner needs a human sidekick." And we have told this story before, but I still think it's great fun, is because that kind of lays down everything that ends up in the books.
Mm-hmm.
And we pitched it to Frank and Kevin, and Frank says, "I don't know." And then like 3 seconds later, he goes, "Wait a minute. I know who that is. I know who that human becomes." And it was like his brain clicked over, and we had the arc up through the second book. And that was fun to write.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those characters, I think, at the end of that book as well, people I had people asking me questions that I don't know the answers to them, but asking like, when are we going to see him again? When are we going to see this character again? When are we going to hear from him and see where his arc takes him? Should we expect to hear or see from anything?
Well,
he's in
Silentium. But we're not going to say what he does in Silentium. There's an awful lot of the stuff that fits into what you're seeing, the results you're seeing in Halo 4, and also the prior stories are all sort of brought together.
There's a lot of blank spaces, too, at the end of Primordium, because in Primordium, you're really following like an Oni investigation of events that happened in the past through information that they're pulling out of this monitor. And so a lot of the book is contextually set within, you know, whatever time frame is contemporary Halo or wherever we're at. But the story that they're telling is like from a history book.
Which I thought was a really interesting, different way of really telling the narrative from the first one.
It's actually gathered by the investigators.
Yes,
a lot of what they're picking up comes from catalog, which they have one version of. And, you know, the juridical monitors and all this sort of thing in catalog are the source. But they also have what they call the Bornstellar relation. You guys are going to have to remind me where the Bornstellar relation was found was on.
I think it was on Installation 00, which is the lesser arc.
Yeah. And at any rate, that's Primordium. Is the Bornstellar relation.
Yeah.
Or no, I'm sorry, that's Cryptum is the Bornstellar relation.
Okay.
And then Primordium becomes a human story. And by the time we get to this, it's an assembly of legal documents telling the investigators' discoveries of what has happened here as they're deposing all our main characters. So in a sense, it's like a legal drama because there's a lot of concern here that laws have been broken, and they have been. But their law is deeper even than the Forerunners realize.
And the Forerunner structure or the Forerunner societal elements are very structurally based. It's based on doing things a certain way and not breaking decorum and going outside those bounds. And definitely the character of the Didact himself seems to be pretty fast and loose with how he breaks with tradition and going against the expected.
Well, he's a strategic thinker. He has to be. He's always dealt with situations that pushed him right to the edge of failure against the humans and the human wars, he nearly lost. And that ticks him off in a sense that almost makes him culpable for what he does in what you could call vengeance, but also to settle people's hash so that history doesn't repeat itself. The librarian has to pull that back a bit because she is concerned, as all Forerunners are supposed to be, with the rule of the mantle. And she's in love with life everywhere, all the aspects of it. But she understands at a deep level that life is conflict. It is things moving against each other to form different shapes, new formations, and to create young. And so she realizes that what the Didact is doing is natural, but is it moral? There's the biological imperative and the legal imperative and the moral imperative, and then there's the spiritual imperative. As they're trying to figure out what this great mystery, the greatest mystery of all, which is, in a sense, talked about in Silentium, which is what is domain? What is it really? And at the end, we begin to discover what domain is. Yeah. And I think we had great fun thinking that out. I think that is really kind of cool. And it adds that extra, again, that extra turn of the screw to the whole story of what have we done here? Mm-hmm.
So I think what's interesting when you kicked off this Forerunner saga, we talked about the fact that there is an end result that you know that kind of ends this portion of galactic history, which is the firing of the Halo rings. And as you move forward into this book in Silentium, you're moving closer and closer to that inevitability. Do you find as a writer, is it more difficult or less difficult the closer you get? Because at the beginning, it's pretty wide open. You're creating whole worlds and galaxies and histories and everything. And as you move closer and closer, there is an expected path that will follow as we get near the end.
The difficulties come with the details of how that happens, because I'm not sure how much it was worked out in the first games, the length of time it took to fire the halos, how they were fired, all that sort of stuff. The ins and outs of actually doing that really require some science fictional thinking and back and forth, because you're dealing with large distances between them, basically. And so I came up with the notion of reconciliation, which is a key sort of fudging factor in all the books, which is you can break beyond light speed. You can travel through portals or however to a great distance, but you pay for it. And you pay for it in a buildup of reconciliation. You need to let that dissipate before you can do this. And moving halos around requires tremendous reconciliation. They're massive. And so when the halos are moving, this interferes with nearly everything else in the economics, the ecumene, of the forerunners. And characters notice, okay, things are kind of slow on the internet today. Does that mean they're moving halos around again? Absolutely. And so that moral obligation, in a sense, that buildup of ecological damage to the space-time continuum is also part of the story. And it clogs up the catalog networks. It clogs up everything. And after a while, domain becomes unavailable because of these massive weapons of war. And again, that's the whole point of preparing the story is actions have consequences. There is no magic here. Everything that's super science, everything that's superhuman in quality has consequences even so. These may be larger than life characters, but they are facing difficulties that are also larger.
Jeremy, from your perspective, I mean, you've been working with Greg probably closer than just about anyone here at the studio.
We became brothers. We bonded and had a blood brother relationship the last 3 months of the book.
And I know, you know, your background with the Halo universe, and at first you ran or worked on Ascended Justice, doing a lot of deep dives into the story elements of Halo. What's kind of your perspective been on this whole journey of the Forerunner saga, of really helping to flesh out this whole aspect of the Halo universe that heretofore has been kind of known.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting in that the site that I worked on, Ascended Justice, was the site that really, I think it was one of the first sites that actually delved deep into the Halo 3 terminals, which at the time were really not something that a lot of people had considered outside of just it being contextual story. So it was interesting to see from this end. And I really didn't get involved too heavily until I'd say about midway through Primordium. But it was fun being sort of in the audience initially and sort of watching the story grow with Frank and Kevin and Greg. And then as we got into Primordium, it was just interesting to see different paths taken, because ultimately the story that's in the terminals in Halo 3 is a result of Mendicant Bias communicating to the player, communicating to the Chief, really, what he wants the Chief to know to get to the end game, which is the last terminal, and to sort of have absolution. Mm-hmm. But how... you know, that actually meted out in real history without the filter of a corrupted Ancilla is really the question. And so seeing Greg fill those gaps in was awesome. And, you know, working with him to make sure, like...
with some help from my friends. I mean, there's a lot of details here that,
sure,
that the group mind absolutely helps me with.
Yeah, because the terminals themselves, there's still, to this day, a lot of questions about what Mendicant Bias meant by this phrase or that phrase. Can players and now readers expect to get any answers to any of those questions this time around?
I mean, I think specific answers, probably not. I think when we look at Halo 3 through the filter of Silentium and through the filter of the Forerunner saga, we have to really recognize the fact that Mendicant Bias, he had problems. He had some issues,
yeah,
that are stated in the terminals and that are stated in Silentium, and you'll find out. I mean, you've probably been able to piece some of that together from Primordium, but he had situations that basically explain the direction that he took when he was communicating these things to the Chief. So there's give and take there in terms of what his story actually meant, but laying out the groundwork through the Forerunner saga, we actually are seeing reality sort of, you know, laid bare.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, like, especially like when you talk about, you know, what Mendicant Bias communicated to the Chief, right? That in and of itself is not an insignificant fact, right? I think that, you know, when we started looking at, you know, the Chief's place in the universe and why the terminals were important, that was a factor. You know, there's a reason why, you know, we decided to tell the Didact story in Halo 4. You know, it was that idea that, you know, things, you know, were coalescing around the Chief. And, you know, it's taken, you know, 10 years of Halo lore to do. But I think that, like, it is not an insignificant thing that, you know,
and that, was,
that contact
not a coincidence.
Was not coincidental.
And that was kicked off in a lot of ways by the first time 343 Guilty Spark came across Chief and the first Halo, and has some very curious turns of phrase that he...
There's curious turns of phrase. So just, I mean, for the record, when people go through Silentium, there's going to be some stuff that they will look at and smile and say, okay, I remember that. Kind of. They'll have to go back and play a few things probably.
Yeah, go back to the early Halos and figure out what's going on.
I wanted to go back to the terminals a little bit because I think for me personally, that some of my favorite part storytelling elements from Halo 4 are actually from the terminals. I thought that they did a wonderful job of fleshing out this kind of this story that doesn't specifically, you know, doesn't take place in the same time frame or anything. I'm wondering if anyone here has any thoughts on kind of what that process was like.
Oh, yeah. They were hugely important for us. That's a story that we knew we wanted to tell really from the very beginning. Again, in terms of talking about the parallels with, you know, the Chief's own journey and you know, the actual story that goes on in the game, it was something that we knew early on we wanted to address. And that we wouldn't necessarily have time to address in the course of the main story. We couldn't necessarily go into a didact level, for instance. That's something that, you know, we had sort of, you know, iterated on over a long period of time with like different groups of people. When Brian Reed and I and Morgan Lockhart, who's on our narrative team, we all sat down, and Armando, we sort of were cracking the story on it. You know, we definitely wanted to show that journey that the didact undertook. We wanted to humanize the character. We wanted to show the weight that was on that character's shoulders. We wanted to show the love between him and the librarian. And again, a lot of what's in the books, and you know, in terms of how the prism that it specifically, you know, you could look at Halo 4 through and how it related directly to Halo 4 was incredibly important for us.
Plus, how to condense 900 pages into, you know, a cinematic or two.
Turned out
impressive,
pretty darn well.
Yeah,
I,
yeah.
You know, to see the visuals come out on this is startling, even though they've been in my head in embryonic form for years, to see what a bunch of really crack designers and artists can do.
And that was fun. We were once again working with the Sequence Group, who we worked with originally with the terminals in Halo Anniversary. And once again,
super talented folks.
Yeah. Amazing.
Batted it out of the park.
Yeah. To describe it, I mean, people use the term motion comic, but I don't think that adequately describes what they do, especially with the work that we've done with them. It's been pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it's a mixed media.
Yeah,
it's you know, the what they were able to deliver far surpassed anything I think any of us expected. You know, and it was you know, a wonderful tool for us, because knowing, you know, where we want to go with the universe and the different themes we want to touch on both in the present and in the future, you know, delving into Forerunner society, delving into the mantle, delving into why that was important, we had to articulate that incredibly well in Sequence. Just, you know, like I said, they brought their A game.
That back and forth between the precursors and the forerunners in Silentium gives you a clue as to how the precursors got where they are too, which is hinted at in Primordium. And that story is another tragedy involving kind of family matters. And I think the whole Halo story evolves out of conflict within a huge galactic family, which now includes us. And so this family controversy continues, which means your actions really do have consequences. You don't know who you're related to when you're fighting them.
Yeah, and you said tragedy, and it's funny because as we've been sitting here talking, that is a word that's, you know, recurs in my mind,
yeah.
Is that so much of the drama comes out of tragedy, and even victories carry tragedy.
As we see in Lord of Admirals, when you are, if we can talk about meeting the Lord of Admirals in a memory sense, beautifully realized, and Lord of Admirals is quite a character in my mind. He nearly defeated the Didact. Really ticked the Didact off, too.
It's interesting you talk about galactic families, and I always go back to my own. Even with your smaller family, you'll have arguments and everything. Especially, I can think about my older brothers will fight amongst each other like we hate each other. But anyone from the outside messes with us, immediately we have like a unified wall. Like it's us and them, very clear. I think what's interesting, when we were first introduced to the Halo universe, humanity had a very solid wall against the Covenant. Covenant itself was pretty solid, and you had some cracks that were starting to show, and those broke wide open in Halo 2. And where we are in Halo 4, those internal conflicts are kind of coming back into play. And clearly, I think one of the main elements of the Forerunner saga is all the cracks of Forerunner society. I mean, at this point, they don't have any of them until they come across the Flood. And at that point, how do they all work together? How do they all pull together and try to defeat this enemy?
The back and forth between the librarian and the Didact is that she, to fulfill her version of the mantle, must reach outside the family. The Didact has a strong sense of who the family is. It's the Forerunners. That's who we're here to save. But the librarian must preserve life. And for the Forerunners to inherit the rule of the mantle, she must do that thoroughly. And so what's coming up is for her an immense crime, just in and of itself. And yet she's married to the man who's going to be setting this up. And yet he also opposed it. So he did not want the halos. He wanted more of an island-hopping strategic approach. We saw that in Krypton. And it turned out that that just wasn't practical given the pressures. And that's the, in Silentium, the Bornstellar Didact and the Ur-Didact are still fighting this over. And the resolution of that, I think, is really, who's the real meanie here in our books? Is it, you know, they all have redeeming qualities. They tried to fight to preserve the mantle, and they failed.
Yeah, I mean, Ur-Didact, even if you listen in the game, yes, he comes across as the antagonist, but, like, there is a sense of pride, a sense of, you know, he believes what he's doing is right. You know, yes, he believes in Forerunner dominance, but, you know, he's not simply just, I want to kill everybody.
There's also the crime that humans perpetrated, which it turns out had its own mitigating circumstances, is they saw humans wiping out entire solar systems.
Yeah.
That's in Silentium. I don't know how deep we can get into that.
Well, and we see that a little bit in the terminals as well.
Yeah. And the fact, the reason that they're doing this is because they're up against the Flood before the Forerunners.
Yeah.
But the Forerunners see this as criminal.
Oh, yeah.
At the early stages, humans are vicious. They don't understand the motivation.
It's like the hubris of perspective in some ways, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Didact's fine with humanity existing as long as they know their place and they know where they – and it's the
squashed down, de-evolved, kept where they're going to be. And the librarian keeps allowing them to rise up again. He does not understand that. It's irritating.
And she betrays him for that.
Yeah,
you know, she literally is called to a point where she needs to choose, and she chooses them over him.
Right.
And, you know, it's heartbreaking. Again, you talk about tragedies.
It's
who
because
wants
of
to be
what
put
she
in
discovers
position?
In the Greater Magellanic Cloud. That discovery changes everything from her perspective.
And I think for the specifics of that discovery, we're going to have to wait until March 19th. I think that's going to wrap us up for this particular episode because – I'm running out of ways of keeping us from going into spoiler territory.
Yeah, we're going to do it inevitably.
Exactly.
Talking, we're going to sit here and start laying.
We're just
going to
turn the record button off and just keep going.
That's
but
right.
I guess until then, Greg, thanks again for joining. Jeremy, Chris, thanks again for joining.
And I wanted to pass on my thanks to everybody on the Halo team for taking these books and working with them and around them and on and turning out such a fantastic piece of art. It really has a depth that you don't see in a lot of games, and that impresses the hell out of me.
We have a very talented art staff here at the studio. We're
story,
pretty lucky.
Art, programming, game design, everything top notch.
Well, obviously we're back with another Sparkcast. We will make sure that it's not quite as long a wait for this next episode. We have some actually really cool stuff planned, especially we have a wealth of people, individuals who worked on Halo 4. We have some opportunities to dig deeper into some of the elements of the creation of the game, maybe point out some stuff people didn't notice the first time around. We're kicking around some ideas. Hopefully we'll have some more specifics in the next month or so about what that's going to break out. And one other thing to point out, we will have a presence at PAX East. So if you are attending that that conference, which is also taking place right after the release of Silentium, actually, it's going to be the week of March 20th. I think it's the 21st through the 24th, or it might be 22nd through the 24th. You can find all the details online. We have a panel there Friday afternoon. It's going to be, I believe, 5:30 starting off. It's going to be mostly focused on the Halo multiplayer. We're going to be talking a little Spartan Ops. And also maybe talking about the future of Halo multiplayer. And we have some cool stuff planned for that panel. And we will be back with more and more episodes this year with Sparkcast as we move this Halo universe forward, post-Halo 4. So thanks, everyone, for joining, and thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.